You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Good evening. Venerable Chodron is currently in India and returns to the Abbey on the 28th, so we're continuing with our review of Nagarjuna's precious garland of advice to a king, relying on the commentary of Khyentse Jompa Tekcho and also Venerable Chodron. So tonight we're looking at quiz number 6, questions 8 through 12, which mainly covers material from verses 115 to 132. So let's begin by generating a motivation for our time together. So reflecting how in our Buddhist practice we're encouraged to understand our mind and how it functions, because it's our state of mind that plays an essential role in our internal experiences of happiness and suffering. Also, there is a very intimate connection between our mind and karma, or actions. Our mind controls our actions, and that determines our experiences, like what kind of rebirth we take, what kind of habits we have, what kind of experiences come our way. And our mind also has an incredible untapped potential to experience reality directly without any distortions or superimpositions. And this is what allows us to purify obscurations and experience uninterrupted well-being. To the extent that we can transform our own mind, we can help others to transform their minds and accomplish lasting happiness and well-being. So tonight, let's engage in this review of Nagarjuna's precious garland with a wish to continue developing our compassion and wisdom, continuing to increase our knowledge so that we can truly benefit all living beings. The principal theme of Precious Garland is an explanation of the methods for attaining higher rebirths as well as highest good of liberation and full awakening or enlightenment. And we also find in the goals of practitioners of the three capacities in the Lam Rim. So these two correlate, we could say. The goal of a person of initial capacity is to avoid an unfortunate rebirth and to create the causes for a higher rebirth. And mainly they do that by abandoning non-virtue and cultivating virtue. So that's how we create higher rebirth. Then highest good has these two aspects. Liberation is one aspect, and full enlightenment or full awakening is another aspect. So liberation is the goal of practitioners of middle scope capacity, principally brought about through engaging in the three higher trainings. And then full awakening or Buddhahood is the goal of practitioners of advanced capacity. And this is where we find the practices of bodhicitta, developing the strongest altruistic wish and engaging in the six perfections and eventually engaging in tantric practice. So Precious Garland explains that higher rebirth is a stepping stone to liberation and awakening. It's not an end in itself. Similarly, the Lam Rim instructs us in the practices held in common with the initial capacity person in order to attain a series of fortunate rebirths. I'm sorry to break it to you, but probably most of us won't achieve liberation or enlightenment in this lifetime. So we need a series of good rebirths so that we can continue progressing along the path. But liberation from cyclic existence is also not an end in itself, and the Lam Rim encourages us to become a person of advanced capacity, someone who's motivated by the altruistic intention of bodhicitta and seeks full awakening of Buddhahood in order to be most effective to benefit others. So in short, the meaning The purpose, the practices of the precious garland and the Lam Rim go hand in hand. So it's nice if we make that connection. Precious Garland was written, when did Nagarjuna live?
First or second century
A.D.? So tonight we're reviewing verses in chapter 2 of Precious Garland. It's the chapter on an interwoven explanation of the causes and effects of higher rebirth and highest good. So higher rebirth is very clear. Highest good is talking about a shorthand for liberation or enlightenment. So we have those three goals. The initial scope of the Lam Rim, or the goal of those practitioners, is to achieve a good rebirth. There are very specific practices to engage in, meditations to engage in, to bring that about. The middle scope practitioner is really aiming for personal liberation for oneself alone, and doing that by engaging wisdom, but also the method side is renunciation, is uncontrived renunciation. And then for the great scope practitioner, it's uncontrived bodhicitta coupled with wisdom realizing emptiness. Okay, so this week we'll start with question number 8. How does realizing emptiness compare to realizing the foulness of the body? Which is easier? Which stays in our mind longer? And in what order are these two realized? Inquiring minds want to know. So you've been thinking about this all day, haven't you? So what verses did you discover in chapter 2 that might relate to this question?
116 and 117.
Verses 116 and 117. Anyone else?
170.
Okay, we'll take a look at that. 169 too. Okay. Well, let's take a look at 116 and 117 to begin with. Nagarjuna says, the impurity of the body is obvious. It is an object of direct perception. Although one can see it constantly, it does not remain in one's mind. If that is the case, then how could this extremely subtle, profound, and unlocated holy dharma, which is not directly perceptible, easily enter one's mind? So in these verses, he's talking about how profound the realization of emptiness is. And if anyone's interested in checking back, these are the teachings from these two verses in particular come from teaching number 29 and number 36 that Venerable gave in November and December of 2015. So let's compare how we develop a realization of these two objects, the foulness of the body and selflessness, wisdom realizing selflessness. So with regard to realizing selflessness, Venerable Children said that we need to keep two things in mind. The first is that we can't see objects like coarse or subtle selflessness with our senses, our sense consciousnesses, or our sense faculties, I should say, because they're slightly obscured objects. So to realize them, we need to use a reason or a correct syllogism to develop our understanding. For example, take the person, it lacks true existence because it's a dependent arising. Or maybe an easier example might be, if we were to look over in that direction and we saw smoke, we'd say, take the smoke on that hill over there. There must be fire. Why? Because there's smoke. So we use inferences all the time. Often our inferences aren't correct. I take myself, I'm not going to study because it's too hard. That's not a correct reason. So we have to check. There are ways to see, to check if reasons that we're using are actually valid, if the syllogisms that we automatically create in our mind are valid or not. Okay, so that's one thing. We can't see objects like coarse or subtle selflessness with our sense consciousnesses. The second thing to keep in mind is that true grasping or grasping at true existence is erroneous with respect to its conceived object, because it conceives of a truly existent or inherently existent object, which is a non-existence. It doesn't exist at all. So since she's brought up this term, conceived object, I thought it might be interesting just to quickly go over those terms. So we'll do that in just a minute. But let's, first of all, let's come back to just how would a person go about realizing selflessness. In Insight into Emptiness, Khyentse Jampa Tekchok says that both Aryadeva and Lama Tsongkhapa present a very systematic way to lead our minds to the full realization of the nature of reality. They both recommend that we begin with easier topics and proceed to more difficult ones. So this reflects the skillful way in which the Buddha presented selflessness to people of different capacities, different predispositions. So we're advised to begin with an explanation of the coarse level of selflessness of person, the person's lack of being permanent, unitary, and independent. Now, no Buddhist schools assert this, but non-Buddhist schools asserted this, especially at the time of the Buddha. And so we begin with that explanation of the very coarse level of selflessness of person. So permanent, unitary, and independent. We understand that the permanent means non-momentary. It's not changing moment. Something that's not changing moment to moment. The object is non-momentary. Unitary means without parts. Independent means it doesn't arise from causes and conditions. So such a self would have to be categorically different from the aggregates, because the aggregates are constantly changing, aren't they? We can observe that. When we sit and do breathing meditation, we can observe that our mind is constantly changing. When we think about the body, or even when we observe the body, we can observe that certain aspects of the body are constantly changing. Shaving our heads as monastics, that's a good reminder that the body's producing hair or the body's producing nails, constantly changing, and so therefore we have to shave or cut our hair or nails. So when we thoroughly investigate how we as a person exist, then we can conclude that there is no permanent, unitary, independent self as was asserted or propounded by these non-Buddhist schools. Okay, so that's where we'd begin. And then having done that, we'd progress to try to understand a more subtle level of persons, the person's lack of being self-sufficient and substantially existent. You've probably heard those terms before. So all Buddhist schools assert that the person is established in dependence upon the aggregates. They'd all agree on that point. The person is imputed in dependence upon the mental and physical aggregates, and actually they are one entity. And that's different than the permanent, unitary, independent situation where the two are different. The person is one entity and the aggregates would be asserted as a different entity altogether. But a self-sufficient, substantially existent person could be called to mind without depending on the aggregates. So there's a disparity, isn't there? That's what substantially existent means, is that you can call that person to mind without depending on anything else like the aggregates. So what's problematic is that the lower schools say that the aggregates are substantially existent, even though the person is imputedly existent. That's one problem. They also assert that an illustration of the person is findable among the aggregates, the basis of designation. So these are a little bit difficult, problematic. But when we thoroughly investigate these assertions, what we can find is that, if we investigate, can we call to mind a person, ourself, or another person without depending on something about their aggregates, that basis of designation. Either we're going to think about their voice or their body, some aspect of their body, some aspect of their mind, to call that person to mind. So, with some good analysis, then we can also conclude that the person can't actually exist that way, as described by these lower schools. Actually, the consequent school, the highest the Prasangikas would say that substantial existence is the same as inherent existence, so all sorts of difficulties there. But then we gradually refine our understanding to reach the subtlest view of selflessness, a person, and phenomena found in the middle way, consequence or prasangika view, that the person is merely imputed, merely designated on the basis of designation, the aggregates. And so how would a person come to understand this? From the consequence point of view, they would be one way to understand this is to rely on a correct reason. So take the person. This person, they lack inherent existence or independent existence. Why? Because they are dependent. They're dependent. This person is a dependent arising. The person depends on being imputed on the aggregates. So how we work with this syllogism is, first of all, we would reflect and meditate on how the person is a dependent arising. So we can think about that. The person depends on the body and the mind, right? And how do body and mind come about? Well, the body is dependent on causes and conditions. It's dependent on sperm and egg of our parents. Thank you very much, Mom and Dad. And the mind, we would say the mind depends on a previous moment of mind. That's how it's explained in the Buddhist tradition. So those two things coming together, we have a dependent arising of body and mind, which is then further imputed as person. So we can establish that the presence of the reason in the subject, or sometimes it's called the property of the subject, that's the first thing we look at. You know, take the self. The self, it is a dependent arising. Or is it? We have to investigate. Also, we reflect on how whatever is a dependent arising, the reason, whatever is a dependent arising necessarily does not truly exist. Because those two things are mutually exclusive, aren't they? They're contradictory. If something is a dependent arising, it can't be independent. It can't be inherent. Those two things are exclusive. So we can understand what's called the forward privation. And then also reflecting that if something is truly existent or inherently existent, it's necessarily not a dependent arising. Because something that is truly existent can't depend on anything else. But would we even be able to find anything that doesn't depend on something else? From this school's point of view, everything is a dependent arising. All right, so just going through those three steps, thinking about gradually developing our understanding of the selflessness of person, we can see that there's actually a lot to think about, isn't there? And there's a lot to investigate. Then if we come back to Venerable's second point, that true grasping, or grasping at true existence, which is what realizing selflessness overcomes, that true grasping is erroneous with respect to its conceived object, because it conceives of a true existent or inherently existent object, which again is a non-existent. It doesn't exist at all. So it might be helpful to understand, it is helpful to understand these different types of objects that a consciousness may have. So we say that every consciousness engages an object. It has an object, right? You don't have a consciousness without an object. And actually, we have to ask, do you have an object without a consciousness? let's not go there right now. Yeah. Okay. But we do know that every consciousness has an object. You won't have a consciousness if it does not have an object to engage. That's what consciousnesses do. So every consciousness has a focal object. The focal object is the main object that the consciousness is concerned with. And the way I've learned this is that the focal object must exist. It has to be in existence. Then consciousnesses also have an appearing object. Are these terms familiar to you? So it's good to review these because they are a little bit difficult. But we do find them again and again, and if we can, and they're not, actually when we really think about them, they're not all that difficult. The appearing object is the object that is appearing to the consciousness, although the appearing object is not necessarily what the consciousness is understanding. So something is appearing to each mind, each consciousness. That's the appearing object. But even though something may be appearing to a consciousness, that consciousness may be understanding something completely different. So appearing object, and we'll use some examples here in a minute to try to understand this. All right, then the third type of object is what's called, now this object has many names, doesn't it? We can call it the engaged object. Venerable likes to call it the apprehended object. If we're talking about a conceptual consciousness, then we can call it the conceived object or the determined object. So many different names for this particular object. But this object, oh, also the object of the mode of apprehension. That's another mouthful. That's what Jeffrey likes, Jeffrey Hopkins. This is the actual object that the consciousness is understanding or comprehending or grasping. So something's appearing to the mind, and that mind is comprehending something. In some situations, the two are the same. In some situations, the two are very different. So
the two
appearing object and engaged object, or if we're talking about sense consciousnesses.
Okay.
So as I was preparing, some doubts came to my mind. You know, sometimes these things seem so simple, so straightforward, when you hear it the first two or three or four or five times, and then all of a sudden you go, huh? I'll try not to share my confusion with you, only my clarity. All right, so let's talk about those three graspings that we were just talking about. If we talk about grasping at a very coarse self, a person, grasping at a permanent, unitary, independent self, what would we say is the focal object for that mind? Remember, the focal object is the main object it's engaged with, and again, my understanding is the focal object must exist. So what would that be? It'd be the self. It'd be the I, the conventional I that exists. Now that I depends on the aggregate, so in a way, you know, that answer is correct too, but we'd say the I. And now this is a conceptual consciousness, isn't it? So what is appearing to that consciousness that's grasping at true existence? Grasping at permanent, unitary, independent self. It's a conceptual consciousness. How does a conceptual consciousness know its object?
Through a mental image.
Through a generic image or a mental image. Yep.
What appears is independent.
Permanent, unitary, independent. Okay, but it's a conceptual consciousness, so it's going to get at that object through the medium of a generic image. So the appearing object would be a generic image of a permanent, unitary, independent self, or I. Does that make sense? It's a conceptual consciousness. It's thinking, you know, it's conceptualizing how the I appears in this permanent, unitary, independent way. So it's a generic image of permanent, unitary, independent self. Now, think for a moment, what would that consciousness be apprehending? Or what would it be understanding? What object is it actually grasping? Not yet. That's right. So the apprehended object, or because it's a conceptual consciousness, we can say the conceived object is a permanent, unitary, independent self, which doesn't exist, does it? But that's what the consciousness is knowing, or apprehending, or grasping. Okay, you're getting warmed up now. Let's go to the next one, grasping at a coarse self, a person. So this is grasping at a self-sufficient, substantial, existent I or person, isn't it? All right, so what's the focal object? Well, it has to exist, right?
It's the conventional I.
It's the conventional I, or we could just say the I. Either one is fine, or the self. And what is the appearing object to that conceptual consciousness?
A generic image of a self-sufficient, substantially existent.
Right. It's a generic image of a self-sufficient, substantially existent I. You know, either in one's own continuum or someone else's continuum. We haven't identified, you know, what kind of self a person it is. But yeah, that's right. So anytime we're talking about a generic image, anytime we're talking about a conceptual consciousness where we're thinking, we're using our mental consciousness, then we're going to rely on the appearing, what's appearing to the mind, although your eyes can be open, what's appearing to the mind through the medium of that mental consciousness is a generic image of something, and in this case it would be a generic image of a self-sufficient, substantially existent I. An I that can appear without depending on anything else. And then what's the apprehended or conceived object in that case?
The
self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Right. So the self-sufficient, substantially existent I or person or self. That's right. Now you're really rolling. Okay, so let's look at the most subtle grasping at self, a person. What's the focal object? It's got to exist. The I. And what's appearing to that mind? So, you know, in those moments where you're strongly embarrassed or you feel strong shame or you have strong attachment or strong anger, if we were to pull our attention from the object and put it inside and really examine how does the I appear, what would appear to the mind at that moment?
True.
It's a conceptual consciousness.
Generic
image of a truly existent I. So anytime we're talking about conceptual consciousness, there's going to be a generic image of something. Okay, so generic image of truly existent I, and what's the apprehended or the conceived object then? Inherently existent I. Yeah. Okay. Now, let's think about a correct consciousness, and particularly here because the question was about wisdom directly realizing selflessness, a person, selflessness. So let's say the wisdom that is directly realizing subtle selflessness of person. Got it in your mind? Or on the board? All right. So what's the focal object of that mind? What's the main object that that mind is concerned with?
Focal object is still the
self. The convention. Yeah, that's right. It's the conventional self. That's exactly right. That's the focal object. Then what's appearing to that wisdom directly realizing subtle selflessness of person?
Emptiness.
Yeah, emptiness. We can say emptiness. We could also say the lack of a truly existent person. Since person or I, self, is the focal object, we can say it's a lack of truly existent person. And then what is the apprehended or conceived object? What's that consciousness, understanding?
Emptiness.
Same thing. Emptiness, lack of a truly existent or inherently existent person. So one of the things that we can really make a strong mental note of is that if we're talking about the grasping at subtle self a person and the wisdom directly realizing subtle selflessness of person, they're looking at the same object, or they're engaging the same focal object. It's the self, the conventional self that exists. But how that self is appearing to them, for one, it's a generic image of a truly existent self. The grasping is holding to a truly existent self, while wisdom directly realizing subtle selflessness as a person is the lack of a truly existent self. It's completely opposite. It's contradictory. And this is why wisdom realizing emptiness can overpower self-grasping ignorance. Slowly, slowly, right? It doesn't happen all at once. But that direct perception crowds out. You know, it's just like if we turned on the air conditioner in this room. It's very warm now, but if we turned on an air conditioner, or opened the windows actually, slowly, somewhat slowly, the cool air, it would take a while for the cool air to pervade the room, wouldn't it? Or if we'd left the windows open all night and we turned on the heat, it would take a while for the heat to make it upstairs or to come into this room. And so it's like that. Wisdom, perception, realizing emptiness. One perceptual realization of emptiness begins to remove the obscurations from the mind, abandon the obscurations from the mind. But it does it in stages, so we have to, the yogi has to meditate on that again and again and again until all the obscurations have been removed. Okay, so we've been talking for, 20 minutes about how a person realizes emptiness, and there, even just the little bit of conversation we've had right now, we can see that it's fairly complicated. You know, it's an involved process, isn't it? So let's compare that now to the process of realizing the foulness of the body. Think about when we first step out of the shower. Don't you feel so clean and fresh? But is that the case? It seems that way. We have to investigate. Okay, so if we just think about the different, on the outside, yes, we've cleaned the skin, but what about all these orifices that we have that produce yucky stuff? Especially this time of the year, the nose produces a lot of obvious discharges, doesn't it? And we have colds. And what about your ears? Ears produce waxy substance, don't they? And the eyes, you notice that crusty stuff that you have to remove in the mornings from the corners of your eyes? And tears, we could say tears are also a contamination of the eye. What about your mouth? How long can you go without brushing your teeth before you can't stand yourself any longer? Or the people around you remind you to go brush? What about your armpits? It's not really an orifice, is it? But I think it's counted in the 9 orifices of the body. The armpits.
It secretes.
Yeah, it's true, it does. Okay, and then do we need to mention the anus? We know there, it's not a very clean place. How about urinary opening? Okay, so these are part of our body, aren't they? How clean are these places? The vagina in women, even the nipples we can talk about. What about the contents of our stomach? Would we consider that clean? It is part of us. I wonder how that pizza's doing in our stomach. We had for lunch. Would that appear clean to us if we saw it? What about the contents of your large and small intestines or colon? How would that appear to you? What about blood? Does blood appear clean when it comes out of the body? Or pus and blood or
smell.
Lymph? It doesn't smell clean? It smells kind of irony, doesn't it? Like iron. You feel compelled to clean it up, that's for sure. So some of us attended the Body Human exhibit last week. Did the muscles and tendons and sinews appear clean to you in that exhibition? Actually, they were kind of sterile, weren't they? They were plasticized, so that's maybe a different situation than if we were to open up our arm and pull out a tendon. So all of this might seem self-evident going through it right now, but do you think people in our culture think of the body as foul? Do we even think of the body as foul, really? I mean, when you were eating that pizza today at lunch, were you thinking, this is going to be tomorrow's poo? But it's true, isn't it? Or when you're drinking a cup of tea, are you thinking this is the urine in a couple of hours? It's going to process through the body. So even though the foulness of our body is directly perceivable to our senses, we can't hold that awareness for very long. We've been conditioned, we've been habituated to thinking of our body as pure. And Even though we may recite the whole mala of my body is clean, my body is clean, my body is clean, my body, my body is foul, my body is foul, my body is foul. Sorry, I went the wrong way, didn't I? But then when we eat pizza or chocolate chip cookies, it appears as if the pizza or the chocolate chip cookies are pure all the way through the body. They have a pureness that stays pure as it goes through all the processes of the body. So the conclusion is that given how difficult it is to hold the foulness of the body in our mind, even though it's perceivable by our senses, we can use that to appreciate how much more difficult it is to hold the selflessness of the eye when it's not perceivable by the senses. That's the point of this question, I think. So we have to go through a gradual process from coarse to subtle and rely on an inference to initially realize selflessness. So how likely is it that we'll be able to hold that concept in our mind compared to the foulness of the body? Okay, so that's not to discourage us, not at all, but it's just to give us a reference point. Because often, as Venerable mentioned when she gave that teaching, she said often people think they can skip over meditating on the foulness of the body and get right to realizing emptiness. But good luck with that. And we might as well go ahead and plug the winter retreat. There's still spaces in the one-month retreat on the four close placements of mindfulness, of which meditating on the foulness of the body is one. So if you have time to join us, please do. Also, I was reminded of these verses, 148 to 170, where Nagarjuna describes the foulness of the body in a lot of detail to help us reduce sexual attachment. Do you remember those verses? Very powerful to read. So, for instance, verse 154. Foolish persons imagine that this city of bugs that is the body with cavities that are sources of filth is something conducive to pleasure. Remember that one? Or the next one. When you yourself see the impurities of excrement, urine, and such, how can the body being composed of them be something pleasant for you? And it goes on and on. Now there's a purpose for meditation. We're not trying to develop aversion to our bodies or other people's bodies. Well, actually, we are, but for a reason. We're trying to overcome the attachment to the erroneous concept of it being pure. Okay, and then verse 166 brings it all together. He says, and he's talking to the king, right, his friend the king, even though you daily rinse off the discharge from your nine wounds, if you still do not realize that the body is impure, then what is the point of explaining this to you? You remember that one? So Nagarjuna says to the king, the dirty nature of our body is visible to direct perception. Every day you see that this body constantly drips filth from its nine orifices, and you have to clean your body daily. Knowing this from your own experience, why don't you realize that the body is impure? If you can't see something as visibly obvious as this, what is the use of explaining it to you? So again, Venerable said that it's even more surprising when we think we can realize emptiness of the self without first realizing this basic foulness of the body. Okay, so does that answer for you the first part of that question? Question number 8. How does realizing emptiness compare to realizing the foulness of the body? Both are difficult. But which one's more difficult? Which one is easier, she says? Which one stays in our mind longer? How did you answer that? Foulness of the body stays in our mind longer. And okay, not sure.
And habit creation. We are very habituated with our body.
Yeah.
Because of the reflection upon emptiness, selflessness, we are not so habituated with familiar normally.
So you say we're more habituated with seeing our body as what, foul or pure?
Not normally as pure, but we know that it's foul. I mean, yeah, we know it stinks here and there, or it's uncomfortable.
We have direct experience that it stinks or it's dirty.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do we have direct experience that the self is selfless? Not yet. Okay.
But if we did, that would stay in our mind quite well. Where when we see the body as foul, oh, then I'm off to get its purity.
Okay, so you're saying that you think the realization of selflessness would stay longer in the mind because...
If you had a direct realization of the selflessness of selflessness, I would think that would stay in your mind quite well. Where we have a, you know, we see the body as foul for a moment, and then we're not thinking like we used to think.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And, you know, when there are some descriptions of realization of emptiness, like in His Holiness's book, The Wisdom of Forgiveness, he talks about a conceptual realization of emptiness. And later on, he clarified that it may have been something like realizing the lack of a self-sufficient, substantial existence self. But he talked about how that impacted his mind for days. I think it was like 2 weeks afterwards. He didn't have to use much reasoning, but that awareness was there. So, yeah, that realization would stay in the mind very strongly.
But so with the realization of the foulness of the body, if we're going to place our concentration or develop a mindfulness of that, that's on the basis of our renunciation.
Yeah, and I think what he's contrasting there is that we have had realizations of the foulness of our body. Oh, gosh, that stinks. Okay, where did that realization go? Probably because it's overpowered by the grasping at the body is pure. So, but
is
what
that
you're talking
about... realization? Or is
that it's a perception of a sense consciousness, isn't it? But what you're talking about is the realization that comes from deep meditation with concentration, like when we're meditating on the four close placements of mindfulness.
Contrived renunciation.
In developing uncontrived renunciation. Yeah. Yes?
I also think that if you think about the aging of the body and that it is... decomposing actually as we speak, that's a different level than just, oh, it stinks here or there or this or that, you know what I mean? So there's different levels of what you can keep in your mind, and maybe as you get older it's easier to keep that in your mind because you're experiencing it, you know?
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of what I think of in more of that way.
Okay. So that sounds more like the subtle impermanence of the body. As opposed to the foulness, but...
Well, yeah, but as it... Maybe it's because of my background, seeing a lot of bodies in various states of illness and disease. So to me, that's all kind of in the same
foulness
space.
Of sickness.
Same, yeah, foulness to me.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Reminder to put the mic up over close to your mouth.
Sorry.
So hearing what Venerable Jigme has said and what Venerable Choni has said, I see that I was comparing a shallow realization of the foulness of the body with a deep realization of selflessness. It's like apples and oranges, really.
Yeah, and I would imagine that a deep realization of the foulness of the body, like a serious yogi in retreat, would have, you know, that would be an incontrovertible, you could develop a realization of that, incontrovertible knower, and as long as you kept that, you know, continued to refresh that realization, you could hold on to that. Okay. All right, let's go on to the next question. Question 9 says, if all sentient beings' consciousnesses except for their meditative equipoise directly realizing emptiness, are mistaken, what does it mean for sentient beings to have reliable cognizers or valid cognizers? If all sentient beings' consciousnesses are mistaken, with the exception of their meditative equipoise directly realizing emptiness, and Arya's meditative equipoise directly realizing emptiness, what does it mean for sentient beings to have reliable cognizers or valid cognizers? Okay, so what verses did you find correlating with this question? I came up with 119 and 120 simply because that's where the explanation was found. So I'm not sure the verses directly speak to this, but the explanation, Kinzer Jampa Tekchok's explanation does. So 119 says, if this Dharma is misunderstood, it will ruin the unwise, for they will sink deeply into the filth of nihilistic views. And more pertinent to 120, and from misunderstanding this, fools who presume themselves pundits, ruined by the denial of it, plummet straight down to Avicii hell. Okay, so maybe it's a little difficult to understand how those verses really address this question, but what we can say is that one unique tenet of the middle way consequence school, the Prasangikas, is that an Arya's meditative equipoise, directly realizing emptiness, is the only unmistaken consciousness, or the only type of unmistaken consciousness. All other consciousnesses are mistaken with respect to the appearance of true existence. Right? So someone might say, you Prasangikas say that all consciousnesses of sentient beings, except for an Arya's meditative equipoise, directly realizing emptiness, are mistaken because they have the appearance of true existence. That leads to the question, then are all the reliable consciousnesses of sentient beings mistaken? That's the question that comes up in the commentary. So this person is thinking that if the Arya's meditative equipoise, single-pointedly focused on emptiness, is the only consciousness that sees things as they actually are, and if every other consciousness is mistaken, then even reliable consciousnesses that tell us what exists and what don't exist wouldn't exist. They wouldn't be reliable consciousnesses because they would also have mistaken appearances. Does that make sense? It's a lot of words, isn't it?
Did you want to say? Would be the debate. That was the debate point from the other person. So how do we answer?
Right. So how are we going to answer this person? Any ideas?
And that's where we say distinction is made between the appearing object and the
conceived
or focal. Oh. So that's where we make a distinction between the appearing object and the apprehended or conceived object.
That's right. Okay, so according to the Prasangikas, a reliable consciousness or a valid consciousness can be mistaken, and this is different. Those of you who like tenets, what we find is that Sutra school, mind-only school, middle way autonomy school say that if it's a mistaken consciousness, if a consciousness is mistaken, it cannot be valid with respect to that object. Middle way consequence school says something very different, and it's because of their, because they identify the most subtle object of negation. Okay, so a valid or reliable consciousness can be mistaken with respect to its appearing object, but not its engaged or conceived object. All right, so we'll go through some examples to help clarify this. First of all, let's just get some facts down. So a mistaken consciousness is posited according to whether the mind is mistaken with respect to its appearing object, the object that is appearing to that consciousness. It is not posited, a mistaken consciousness is not posited in relation to its apprehended object or conceived object. It's not posited in relation to the object it's understanding.
The mistakenness.
Yeah.
It's not posited.
Yeah, the mistakenness is not, the mistakenness of the consciousness is not posited in relation to how it's engaging the object or apprehending the object or conceiving the object. Just how it's appearing to the mind. So a mistaken consciousness does not necessarily misapprehend its apprehended or conceived object. A wrong consciousness or an erroneous consciousness, however, is erroneous or wrong in relation to its conceived, appearing or conceived object. So let's work through some examples to see if we can make this clear to our mind. So how about an eye consciousness apprehending a pin? Let's let's say this is a pen. Okay, an eye consciousness apprehending a pen. What is the appearing object?
Pen.
It's a pen, isn't it?
Generality of a pen.
Eye consciousness.
Eye consciousness. Directly.
So an eye consciousness perceives the pen. Now, here's the tricky bit with the Prasangika school, because the eye consciousness, the appearing object for the eye consciousness is pen appearing with an appearance of true existence or inherent existence. Now, normally when we talk about appearing objects and engaged objects or apprehended objects, it's being presented from the sutra school point of view. So don't get confused. This is like a subtle point of view or a subtle unique tenet of the consequent school. Okay. When we're studying philosophy, when we're first introduced to these ideas of appearing object, focal object, conceived object, we're talking from a sutra school point of view. And then later on, when you get to the Prasangika tenets, then they make these distinctions and they talk about, okay, but consequence says it's a little bit different and it's this way. So right now, what's interesting is Nagarjuna is talking from a consequence point of view. Because he's saying, yes, the lower schools would say the appearing object is a pen. And they would say it's unmistaken because it's direct perception. It's appearing truly existent to a sutra school practitioner, but they, well, let's say inherently existent. It appear, well, even true existent, right? We know, but we don't know yet. Say it's a great exposition person. The pen appears to be truly existent. They say, well, it is truly existent. There's no problem with that appearance. It's a valid mind. Consequentialists are the only school that say inherent existence is the most subtle object of negation. It doesn't exist. So when things appear, like a pen appears truly existent or inherently existent, that's a mistake. However, what does that mind comprehend about the pen? So we're not talking about grasping at truly existent pen. We're talking about eye consciousness apprehending pen or eye consciousness seeing pen. The apprehended object is pen. That's what it understands. What appears is a pen with this aspect of inherent existence. And what it understands is pen. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions about that?
The eye consciousness doesn't understand it's a pen.
It does, actually. If we're very familiar with pen, it's not labeling pen, but it understands this as a pen. Just like eye consciousness can understand a person, even though what actually appears is shape and color.
Understand?
But it comprehends person. You can comprehend person with your eye consciousness, even though it's seeing shape and color.
For me, comprehending and understanding are different things.
Why? What does comprehend mean to you? We can use the word understand, that's fine. What's it understanding? What is it knowing about that object? What's it knowing? Like, eye consciousness that's looking at this knows pen, right?
It sees pen.
It sees,
but,
yeah.
But isn't it a mental consciousness that knows?
Yeah.
No, you can even know that, with eye consciousness, you can know that this is a pen. Now, a mental consciousness will, in the next second, appear and start saying, you know, that's my pen, or that's my favorite pen, or that pen is out of ink, or, you know, there will be some commentary about the pen. But in the first moment, there's a direct perception of pen. And that mind knows pen. What else would it know? Well, it does know the shape and the color of the pen, but it also knows pen because it's familiar with pen. We don't need to wait for a mental consciousness to label pen. Now, if we're seeing something that is new to us that we haven't known before, maybe that's a different situation, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about familiar objects that appear to minds. So, from the consequence point of view, eye consciousness apprehending pen, the appearing object, we can say pen appearing as truly existent or inherently existent. Meaning, this pen appears to be just independent from its own side, like it's not dependent on all the people in the factory who made it and all the people who transported it and all the different causes and conditions, the plastic and the ink and the felt and the tip and all that stuff. The causes and conditions, the parts, and the basis of designation. So the appearing object is pen. I would say, let's see what Venerable said. She said, okay, for example, a visual consciousness sees a pin. The pin appears truly existent to that mind, but that mind does not apprehend or grasp the pin as truly existent, because it's just an eye consciousness. This visual consciousness is mistaken with respect to its appearing object, a pin that appears truly existent. But it's not erroneous with respect to its apprehended object, the pen. So it's only mistaken with respect to the appearance of true existence. It is correct with respect to it knowing pen, or it understanding pen. Yeah?
Could you say it's correct with regard to conventional existence?
Well, this is a conventionally existent object, so it is correct with... Yeah, I mean, it's a conventional valid cognition, so it's only engaging a conventional object. That's true.
Is this your qualm?
Okay, so I was discussing a qualm with Venerable Chuni earlier, and that is that I've never seen an appearing object described as, for instance, truly, a pen appearing as truly existent. And I wonder if that's because most of the discussion about mind takes place from the sutra school point of view.
Uh-huh.
So this is something I'll need to follow up with.
Why is that? Why is it? It's talked about through the sutra school.
Well, one of the great contributions of the sutra school is their precision with which they describe how things exist. Objects and object possessors or subjects, consciousnesses. And so what we find in the sutra school is this very detailed explanation of how objects exist, how consciousnesses exist. And then what you find in the later tenet schools is just some fine tweaking of how they deviate from the sutra school presentation. So things like, topics like collected topics that we find in Dan Perdue's debate book, that's all from the sutra school point of view. When we study mind and awareness or mind and mental factors, that's from the sutra school point of view. Many of these initial or foundational subjects, we could say, are presented from the sutra school point of view. So this text, although it wasn't labeled a prasangika presentation until many, many centuries later, right, when Chandrakirti clarified the subtle distinctions, but still, we can see from his presentation, you know, for all intents and purposes, he's talking about how every consciousness, other than Arya's meditative equipoise on emptiness, is mistaken. That is a unique prasangika tenet, point of view. Okay, let's do some others, just so we have some...
So that's not your question, that all consciousness is essentially being accepted to recover.
No, I accept that.
Okay.
But how it's usually, how I remember it being described is that the appearing object of eye consciousness apprehending pen would be pen, and it's just mistaken with respect to this aspect of appearing truly existent, as if those two things were separate, and this is what I need to clarify.
Okay.
Okay. Did you have a question?
Realization of emptiness, like a Buddha would
Buddhas don't have any conceptual minds, and here we're talking about, it's distinguished that we're talking about sentient beings. So we've excluded Buddhas. So Buddhas are kind of like in a separate category. And Buddhas have, at the same time that they see the emptiness of an object, they also have exalted knowledges that realize the relative nature of an object. So it's like indescribable.
Okay, that makes it simpler.
Okay.
Because I don't know anything about Buddhas. Okay, so, but I'm a little bit confused about
Let's do some more examples, and I think it'll clarify. And if it doesn't, then bring your question back up, okay? All right, so we've done eye consciousness, apprehending pen. How about mental consciousness? Apprehending pen. Okay, you've seen a pen, now you're thinking about pen. What's the appearing object?
Generic
image of the pen?
Of an inherently existent pen.
Generic image of a pen appearing as inherently existent. I'm not sure if it makes a difference to say generic image of an inherently existent pen or a generic image of a pen appearing as inherently existent. I don't know if those two things are getting at the same thing. We can leave that as a doubt. I'm not sure. But let's just say for now. So it's a generic image or a conceptual image of a mental image of a pen appearing as truly existent. Okay, so it's mistaken with respect to that appearance of true existence. Now, what's the apprehended object? What is that conceptual consciousness understanding? Pen. That's right. So it's valid, isn't it? It's valid with respect to what it understands. It's valid with respect to its conceived object in that case, because it's a conceptual consciousness. All right. How about mental consciousness grasping truly existent pen? What's the appearing object? Mental consciousness grasping a truly, this is my pen. Generic image of a pen appearing as true, or yeah, generic image of truly existent pen. So, that's still mistaken, isn't it? What's the conceived object in that situation? What's it knowing?
Same as the appearing object?
No, it's not knowing the generic image. It's knowing, not just pen, truly existent pen. Because it's grasping at pen and it's holding it. I mean, it's a wrong consciousness, right? So we know it's wrong with respect to its conceived object. Truly existent pen does not exist. That's why it's wrong. There is no truly existent pen. Independent pen. Pen that exists without depending on anything else. Okay, so there we see that mental consciousness grasping at true existence is mistaken with respect to its appearing object. It's also erroneous or wrong with respect to its conceived object. Okay. Remember in that first question, I think it was Venerable made the comment about true grasping, which is what realizing selflessness overcomes, is erroneous with respect to its conceived object. Because it conceives of a truly existent or inherently existent object, which is non-existent. Okay. All right, let's do just a couple more, and then we'll go quickly to 11, 10 and 11. So what about an inferential cognition realizing emptiness? Okay, so it's an inferential cognition. That's necessarily a conceptual mind, isn't it? We'll just leave it kind of vague, it's an inferential cognition of emptiness. So what is the appearing object? I'm really making you work tonight.
Generic image of
Wonderful. It's a generic image of emptiness. Is it appearing as if it's truly existent?
Yes, I'm afraid
it is. Because all consciousnesses except an Arya's meditative equipoise, one pointedly focused on emptiness, is mistaken with respect to its appearing object. All right, and what is the conceived object of that inferential cognition of emptiness? What's it understanding?
Emptiness.
Emptiness, that's right. So it's correct, isn't it, with respect to its conceived object. Therefore, it's a valid cognition. Okay, and then just to bring home the point, maybe this gets at your question, Alex. What about wisdom directly realizing emptiness? What is the appearing object?
Emptiness.
Right. Is there an appearance of true existence?
Yeah.
No! That's right, because it has to be in the continuum of an Arya being. And so it's non-mistaken. What about the conceived, the apprehended object of that consciousness? Emptiness. That's right. Okay. Now, do you still have a question about that?
Or yeah, well, I have many questions, but we don't have any time, and I feel like none of them will get answered anyway. Yeah, there's a lot of things that on lots of background I would need to
okay.
have knowledge on in order to really communicate with you.
Okay. Come to tenants. All right, question number 10. I think we've... The point of this is to say that all the conventional valid cognitions in the mind of sentient beings, not all of them are, even though all of them are mistaken, it doesn't mean that they're erroneous. Like, for instance, our conception of bodhicitta, our conception of loving kindness and compassion, those can be valid minds. Those are valid minds, even though they are mistaken with respect to an appearance of true existence. Okay. Why does Nagarjuna recommend we practice generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude until we realize emptiness? And how does our practice of these three change once we realize emptiness? Any ideas about that?
Well, one thing, we need to keep creating merit to have the precious human rebirths so that we and have the opportunity to continue to cultivate our wisdom, for one thing.
That's one very important thing. Right, we need a series of, uninterrupted series of higher rebirths during which we can practice the Dharma and eventually attain liberation and full awakening.
We need merit to realize emptiness.
And we need merit to realize emptiness.
Yes.
That's right.
We need to quit creating negative.
And we need to stop creating negative karma because that slows us down, doesn't it? Okay. Did you find a verse?
125.
Verse 125. And 126? Okay. I think that goes with the next one. So 125 says, therefore, as long as you have not understood this dharma that destroys eye-grasping, or grasping at the self, devote yourself to the dharma of generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude. In the commentary, Geshe Tekchok says, until you can eradicate the view of personal identity or grasping at the self, by generating the wisdom realizing emptiness, Nagarjuna advises us to train in the practices of generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude, which include or subsume the 16 causes of higher rebirth that Nagarjuna spoke about in Chapter 1. Probably you remember those. The 10 non-virtues, right? Avoiding... the 10 virtues. I thought it was abandoning the 10 non-virtues. In addition to that, not taking intoxicants, maintaining proper livelihood, abandoning harm, respectful generosity, honoring the worthy with respect, and cultivating love. So here, in addition to that, he's suggesting four types of generosity. You remember those? The generosity of... material objects, love,
Dharma teachings,
giving the Dharma,
security,
fearlessness, protection from fear. Yeah. Okay. And then the three types of fortitude or patience, which we covered just this week in Jeffrey's class, but it's a little different here. What are those three types of patience?
Patience not to retaliate.
Patience not to retaliate when harmed.
With suffering.
The patience enduring hardship or suffering.
And patience to practice.
The patience,
fortitude,
the fortitude or patience to practice the Dharma, especially the patience required or the fortitude required for realizing emptiness. Okay. Number 11, what are the five advantages of practicing ethical conduct? Mentioned in Precious Garland. I'm sure there are many more, but...
says it right here.
does, doesn't it? Verse 126 and 127. King, if you undertake deeds that begin with Dharma, have Dharma in the middle and Dharma at the end. One, you will not be harmed in this world or the next through Dharma. Two, you attain fame. Three, pleasure. Four, you have no fear now or at death. And five, in the next world, you will have great joy. So always devote yourself to the Dharma. So he's giving this advice to his friend, the king, understanding that the king has great influence, and if the king is practicing these things, chances are good that others will take notice and practice them too. So he's trying to influence his friend so his friend can influence all the people that the king has influence over. And then the last question, number 12 in this quiz, why is it important that a leader practice ethical conduct? What's your instinct? Did I just say it?
Because of his influence.
Yeah. Okay. I knew it was in my mind for a reason. Okay. I think that correlates with verse 128. Dharma is the highest policy. Dharma pleases the world. And if the world is pleased, you will not be deceived here or hereafter. And also verse 132. If you wish to make your foes unhappy, do away with your faults and enhance your good qualities. That way you will gain great benefit and your enemies will also be displeased. That is very good advice. Okay. So that's probably enough for one night. Any short questions? If there's a possibility of providing an answer for? Okay. Thanks for your participation. And we'll dedicate.
May we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, source of good and happiness, our foe tempting Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the spiritual
teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds all. Omniscient King of the Shakyas, Madhali Tara, Supreme Bestower of Longevity and Wisdom, Vast Ocean Assembly of Sources of Refuge, grant propitiousness here and now for a nectar of benefit and bliss to flow. With a clear mind of extensive learning gained from following the wondrous traditions of Thupten, the Able One's teachings, you bring clarity to masses of disciples with the light of children, the lamp of the Dharma. May your lotus feet remain unfaltering for a very long time. Through your dharmic deeds of hearing, thinking, meditating, and so on, place those who seek the liberated path in harmony through immaculate discipline. Please lead all beings to liberation with undefining excellent qualities of scripture and insight, and establish them in the glory of eternal bliss.
May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Bastiavia.